This morning we're going to conclude a three-week series called SCO. Say that with me. I'm so glad it is only 3 weeks because that is a really stupid title. You see, SCO is a ridiculous expression I use all the time. It means let's go, but I say SCO because we don't have time to say let. Say it again with me. The series is based on the first three verses of Hebrews chapter 12. The passage reads, "Therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of faith. For the joy set before him, he endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who endured such opposition from sinners, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart." During the first week of our series, the writer of Hebrews challenged us to get rid of anything and everything that's getting between us and God. Anything and everything. And that might be a good thing, because sometimes good things get in the way of great things. Last week, our author warned us, the race will be hard. We'll face detours, obstacles, problems, pain. So if we're going to run this race to the end, we have to recognize going through pain is inevitable. Growing through it is optional. This week, I'm going to sum up this series by challenging you, in light of all that we've talked about and in light of all that Jesus has done, run to Jesus, like Jesus, with Jesus. Before we return to Hebrews 12, let's pray together. Lord, draw us close to you in spirit, that we might hear your voice. Draw us close to you so you won't have to shout. I pray you quiet our lives so we can listen and receive today. But if that doesn't work, by all means, go ahead and shout. Hoot, holler, whoop, and roar. Some of us need to be roused from stupor and stirred to action. So may your word break through our stubborn psyches, that we might see the opportunity that lies before us to take our souls seriously, to stop settling for a half-lived life of compromise and throw ourselves into a life of faith in Jesus. We pray this in the name of King Jesus, who came running after us even when we were running the other direction. Amen. As we've seen through our series, the writer of Hebrews uses a sports metaphor. The life of faith is like a race. If we're going to run this race to win, it's going to take training. It's going to take endurance. It's going to take focus. It's going to take passion. You've got to want it. You've got to develop a steely determination if you want to get the prize. The problem is, a lot of us claim to run after Jesus, but in fact, we're lounging in the locker room sipping Gatorade. Look, different messages require me as a communicator to adopt different tones. When the subject is grief, the most appropriate tone may be more pastoral, as a shepherd. When the subject is joy, the tone should be upbeat. When the subject is sex, I should get a guest speaker. But since the writer of Hebrews hands us an athletic metaphor, I decided today I'm going to talk to you like a coach. It's Coach Troy. My friends, here's the thing. I am constantly confronted with followers of Jesus who have embraced a weak stick, namby-pamby faith, a conviction that buckles under the pressure of adversity or affliction or inconvenience, a confidence in God that is absolutely unshakable on sunshine days when life is a picnic, but is quickly abandoned when that faith costs something. We complain about all the problems we face. We complain about all the prayers left unanswered. And these concerns lead to a pretty little pity party to which we invite anyone who wants to attend. Are you kidding me? We are in the middle of a race, people. Go! Look, your complaints and concerns are real and they deserve measured consideration in our journey of faith, but I suspect there are more than a few of you here who need Coach Troy to look you in the eye, tell you to peel yourself up off the floor and run to Jesus like Jesus with Jesus. Run to Jesus like Jesus with Jesus. That's the secret of running right. The writer of Hebrews says in verse 1, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us, fixing our eyes on Jesus. See, this is the key to running your race right. Fixing your eyes on Jesus. This action is about direction, inspiration, empowerment. If you're going to run your race well, you got to set your sights on Jesus. Jesus juggles multiple roles in this race. He's the pioneer and perfecter of faith. The word we translate pioneer is an interesting word in Koine Greek, archagos. In Greek, it has rich meaning. It means leader and founder. It means author and originator. It means forerunner, both literally and metaphorically. But the word also carries with it this idea of source. It means he showed us how to run, and then he helps us run. Now, if you're listening carefully, you know what I said makes no sense. How could a runner run but help us run? It's impossible. But Jesus has God in the flesh, and he can do whatever he wants to do. And that's why we can display this nonsensical graphic on the screen, run to Jesus, like Jesus, with Jesus. He's going to show you where to run, how to run, and help you run. The author of Hebrews tells us he's also the perfecter of faith. That means he's the paragon, the archetype, the perfect example of faith. You want to see what faith looks like? Look at Jesus. You want to see how to run your race? Carefully examine the life and the teaching of Jesus. For instance, if you want to know how to run your race right, go to the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapters 5 through 7, and you'll hear Jesus teach you everything you could do with anger, you could do better without it. He'll teach you, lust isn't liberty of the mind, it's slavery of the soul. So think about what you're thinking about. When it comes to being truthful and being true-ish, Jesus says, live like you're always under oath. Living in the light of truth is truly living. When you have a colleague who ridicules your work, when you have a boss who can't say anything nice, when you're fed up with your mom's relentless nagging, when everything in you wants to let him have it, everything in you wants to turn the tables and give him a taste of your own medicine, Jesus says, turn the other cheek. He says, don't fight back, love back. Then in Matthew 6, he tells us, money acts like a god, promising power, protection, provision, and pleasure. Money acts like a god, but we should never trust it as a god. But instead, we should seek first God's kingdom and God's way of living, and he'll give us everything we need to do, everything he wants us to do. We are called to run to Jesus, like Jesus, with Jesus. Jesus was the pioneer and perfecter of faith. Now think about that. It's hard to do both. When we have athletes who compete, usually they're one or the other. Oh, you're the gal who did it first, and you're followed by others who learned to do it better. But Jesus, right out of the gate, pioneered perfect faith. You say, but Troy, that was Jesus. I know, that was Jesus. And you're not called to be Jesus. You're called to follow Jesus. You're called to run to him so you can learn to be like him as you run with him. Hebrews 12 describes him further, saying, for the joy set before him, he endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Endured is the verb form of perseverance, a word we studied last week. We know suffering on our race. Jesus knows suffering on his. But I don't think I'm going out on a limb when I say his suffering was worse than yours. Death by crucifixion was one of the cruelest forms of torture and execution ever invented by humankind. His pain was excruciating. But Jesus didn't merely bear pain, he bore shame. Crucifixion was humiliation by design. Gold crosses were not proudly worn around necks of Roman citizens in their Jewish wards. A cross symbolized disgust and disdain. as the wretch who hung naked on its wooden beams is stripped of all dignity. Well, the writer of Hebrews tells us Jesus scorned the scorn. Jesus sloughed off the shame as if it were ludicrous. He says to the world, I don't care what you think about the cross because I care about you. And when he suffered and died, he bore the penalty of sin so you and I might be restored to relationship with a God who forgives and a God who teaches us how to live. That's one of the many ways he's both pioneer and perfecter. He runs the race and helps us run ours. We're told he does this for good reason. Here's his motive. For the joy set before it, he endured the cross. Many scholars will say that joy that was set before him was the opportunity to sit at the right hand of God, the Father's throne. And that may be true, at least in part. But think about it. The fact of the matter is, Jesus was already at the right hand of the Father. Philippians 2 tells us he gave up that right when he went to the cross. So what's the joy set before Jesus? What was the one thing he didn't have there that he would have there if he endured the cross? You know what it is? It's you. It's me. We're the joy set before him. Verse 3 challenges us to consider him who endured such opposition from sinners so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. This word consider is a synonym to the word fixing from verse 2. And both words emphasize careful deliberation, undivided attention. A lot of people misunderstand the meaning of this text. I don't think it's asking you to simply contrast your pain and Christ's pain and then man up. Or woman up, because we all know women have a higher pain tolerance than men. No, I think the writer's merely asking you to, not merely to think about Jesus, but he's telling you to come to Jesus. See, if you want to keep from growing weary and losing heart, Jesus himself told you what to do in Matthew 11 and verse 28. He says, come to me, all who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I'm gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your soul. For my yoke is easy, and my burden is light. We've unpacked this verse before. It's an invitation to come to Jesus, to be with Jesus, so we can be like Jesus. Taking on his yoke means taking on his teaching, his way of doing life. So in Hebrews 12, when the writer wants us to fix our eyes on Jesus and consider him with undivided attention, he's talking about prayerful concentration on the presence of Jesus with you in the present. He's telling you to run to Jesus, like Jesus, with Jesus. Now, when you run to Jesus, when you seek him with all your heart, as the Bible instructs, the resurrected Christ reveals himself to you. When you sense him with you, you experience him teaching you how to live free of fear, free of sin. Let me tell you how this works. I have a friend that I've had the privilege of journeying with in Jesus. She lives in Southern California, and she happens to work in one of my favorite places on earth. The place is called Snooze. Have I ever told you about Snooze? Did you moan? You just moaned. You're hungry, aren't you? Oh, you're going to love this. See, I got to tell you, I know I show you photos of Snooze about once a quarter. These are new photos. I just took these back in January. That's a cinnamon roll pancake on your right with white chocolate chips and cinnamon butter. You'll see a chorizo breakfast taco on the left filled with hollandaise and manna, along with a side of cheesy grits. Note in this photo, I asked for egg whites on the taco because I was dieting. Now, hear me. I know I keep showing you photos like this, but the reason I do is because I want to run to these pancakes because I like these pancakes and I want to be with these pancakes. Here's their molten chocolate pancake. It's topped with pomegranate seed. They do that to assuage your guilt. Now, you look at these photos, you might fear that I'm overeating when I go to Snooze. Hey, just know, it's not my fault. Really, they keep bringing me free food. See, I'm there often enough. It's all hugs and high fives when Troy walks in. and they bring me free pancakes. It's not my fault. I would be rude if I refused. This, by the way, is a Black Forest pancake on your left. It was free. But check this out. This is a habanero pork belly eggs Benedict with seared cider braised habanero pork belly atop a lightly buttered and toasted English muffin spread with bacon espresso jam. Perfectly poached eggs with a golden yellow center that flows over a dish that's topped with cream cheese hollandaise and a dollop of cranberry relish. Now, if you are thinking that the gourmet pancake on the side of this photo makes this too much food, I know, but it's not my fault. They gave it to me. Here's why I'm telling you this story. Over the years, the servers at Snooze and I have had countless conversations about faith. I was speaking with one friend in particular last month. She's a single mother, raising a son, and taking care of her mom on a single income. She's also a disciple of Jesus. And we've talked about some of her struggles in the past, but this time, my friend looks different. She's always wore a smile, but this time it seems brighter. What gives? She tells me, "Troy, everything's going wrong." I say, "Tell me more." She says, "Everything's going wrong." And she proceeds to tell me about some of those everythings, from the difficulties of shared custody of her son to the engine of her only car burning out on the way to work that morning. But she says, "Troy, I have been more intentional about staying connected to God every day, reading the Bible, breathing little prayers between orders, and I feel incredible." I exclaimed, "That's what faith feels like. That feeling right there. That's what faith feels like. That's what faith sounds like. That's what faith looks like. That's called running your race right. You run it to Jesus, like Jesus, with Jesus." Now, to illustrate that kind of faith, I'm going to take you to a psalm. It's Psalm 16. Because Psalm 16 is written by a songwriter who's run the race of faith. And from his ancient perspective, his words describe what that race looks like, feels like, and sounds like. Now, Psalm 16 is actually one of my favorite psalms. But I looked back over 20 years of records to discover I've never taught through this psalm in its entirety. But I'm going to now at breakneck speed. Psalm 16, verse 1. David, who writes the psalm, writes, "Keep me safe, my God, for in you I take refuge." Note, the psalm begins with a prayer. And any runner worth her salt breathes prayers like this through every day of her race. The word "keep" translates the Hebrew word shamar. It's one of my favorite verbs in the Bible when God is the subject. It means to guard, preserve, protect, watch. It's a big word with a big meaning. Think of the consummate care of a loving parent. And parents of small children know, as parents, we probably spend less time and energy keeping our kids safe from strangers or circumstances, and more time keeping them safe from themselves. That's true of us too. God keeps us, often from ourselves. That's shamar. Lord, keep me. Keep me safe from sin. Keep me from jealous thoughts. Keep me from bad habits. Keep me from anger and anxiety and lust. Keep me from negative thoughts that seep into my soul and rob me of joy. Keep me from using my words to discourage people around me. Keep me from screwing up my marriage. Keep me from screwing up my kids. Keep me from screwing up my church. Lord, keep me from running to anything but you as a refuge. Don't let me run to the admiration of others. Don't let me run to the comfort of a pineapple upside down pancake, which I may or may not have in about 2 days. Runners who run right pray like that all the time. Romans 12:12, we read it last week. Be joyful in hope, patient in affliction, faithful in prayer. I want to focus your attention on the last phrase in that verse. The word faithful is probably too weak of a translation. It's an intense verb, proskatereo. Proskatereo is a fierce and relentless devotion to something. And in this case, that devotion is directed toward prayer. Now, most of us in crisis have a fierce and relentless devotion to worry. We stew and we stress about our problems, thinking that's helping. That's not helping. But Paul wants us to throw ourselves into the activity of prayer. Instead, consider the wisdom of Anne Voskamp. She says, worry is merely the illusion of taking action, when really prayer is. Let that sink in. Worry does nothing but wear you out on your race. Let me take a survey. Any of you ever run a marathon? Raise your hand. No, it's okay. It's okay. Be proud for a moment. It's good. Good for you. Good for you, says Coach Troy, who was in band. Now, just out of curiosity, how many of you have ever done a marathon binge watch of a show? Raise your hand. No, good for you. It's very comparable. It takes a similar level of stamina. Good for you. Now, for those of you who have run a marathon, here's what I want you to do as an illustration of worry. Next time you set out, about a quarter mile in, I want you to start flapping your arms like this for about a half mile. See what happens. That's what worry does on our race. What if instead we devoted ourselves to prayer? Lord, keep me. Psalm 16, verse 2. David says, I say to the Lord, you are my Lord. Apart from you, I have no good thing. Oh, I wish we had time to unpack this text in full. A few things jump out. They jump off the page to me in this verse. First, in English, this verse looks redundant. I say to the Lord, you are my Lord. Well, you got to know what the thing behind the thing with the text. So when in English, in most of our English translations, when you see the word Lord, all in caps, L-O-R-D, that is an indicator that the Hebrew word that word translates is actually the name Yahweh, and it's the personal name of God, okay? The name that he gave Moses at the burning bush. I am who I am, Yahweh, okay? When you see the word Lord, that's not in caps, usually in Hebrew when it's in the Old Testament, it translates the word Adonai, okay? Now, there's a reason that translations have historically capped the word Lord in replace of Yahweh. There was this old tradition developed by the Jewish people centuries after they were given this name, that out of respect to God, rather than saying the name Yahweh, they instead replaced it. They wrote the words, and they were okay writing the words, but every time they wrote the word Yahweh, they would actually say Adonai, which is another, which is Lord. And so that's why the English translations follow in suit. Okay, God never required that we do that, but the Jewish people, out of respect to God, started to do that. In fact, when I was a Hebrew student some 20 years ago, that's how I learned to read texts. When we read through Hebrew texts, every time I saw the name Yahweh, I was trained to read Adonai. Okay? Now, I want you to understand what's going on in the text. He says to God, calls him by his personal name, and with great excitement, he says, you are my Lord. Now, when you see that word Lord, Adonai, it emphasizes God's role as Lord, as King, as Master. A king like that has a will that must be obeyed. Basically, what David is saying as he's running his race right, you are my Lord, and I'm excited about obeying you. Moms, I want you to imagine your six-year-old bragging to his friends, I love obeying my mom. Everything goes better for me when I listen to mom. Well, it's true, right? That's what David's saying. You are my Lord. I am your servant. He says, apart from you, I have no good thing. He knows God is the source of all that is good in his life. Look at verse 3. I say of the holy people who are in the land, they are the noble ones in whom is all my delight. Now, this is a tricky text to exposit, but I'll make it quick. It means David takes delight in people who are faithful to God. They're the people he runs with, his posse. David identifies himself with them joyfully. This week, out of the blue, I got two phone calls from my two oldest friends in the world. One of them I met when I was 4, and the other one I met when I was 1. Both are passionate followers of Jesus, and both shared with me stories of the race that they are running and wanted to hear about the race that I am running. I'm telling you, there's nothing like the experience of spiritual friendship. People who love God and love you running the race with you. This week I had lunch with a pastor, and it's a pastor that I'm particularly close to on this journey of faith. And we sat together. It had been a little while since we caught up, and we just reviewed 2019 together. And we laughed together and we cried together. And I walked away from that experience reminded of the healing power of spiritual friendship. It's breathtaking. Yesterday I was reminded of this when in the morning, Saturday morning, I felt the tug of God that I was supposed to do something a little bit different with this message for the weekend. And you got to understand, by that point, the ship sailed. We've already got graphics designed, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But I contact my dear friend and longtime colleague, Kelly Johnson, who's our artist. He's sitting in the room right now making things happen on that screen right next to me. I said, Kelly, what do you think about this? And I just started to pitch to him some thoughts and some ideas. And I got this sense. I mean, I can't explain it, but I just got this sense. God is going to speak through my spiritual friend. And sure enough, he did. And it's actually Kelly's insights into discipleship, his own discipleship, but also your discipleship to Jesus, that really shaped this message and made it what it is today. I'm so thankful that I'm surrounded by spiritual friends who can help me find strength in God and help me hear from God. You know, most of the trouble we get into happens because we've cut out our spiritual friends, if we have any at all. I'm going to challenge you. Do what David did when he ran his race right. Do what David did and surround yourself with some of God's holy ones, God's faithful people who love him and love you. Surround yourself with spiritual friends. Now, maybe you're in a season in which you used to have spiritual friends, but they moved away. Well, let's do something about it this year in 2020. Do whatever you need to do to cultivate spiritual friendship. It's going to take trial and error. It's going to take risk because you might get hurt. You're going to be confronted with your insecurities. Absolutely, absolutely. But hear me, healing is available. And my hunch is that kind of healing is going to happen in a context of spiritual friendship. So I'm going to challenge you. Take a risk. Listen to what Eric said earlier when he talked about our small groups. Not everybody has to be in a small group to have spiritual friendship, but I found as a pastor, small groups are usually the best way for someone who's new to a community of faith to enter a community of faith. Take a risk. Check out our small groups before you leave. At that stage area in the cafe, we're going to have a list of small groups we'd like to tell you about that are just starting. And we want to encourage you to dive in to spiritual community. Look at verse 4. David writes, those who run after other gods will suffer more and more. I will not pour out libations of blood to such gods and take up their names on my lips. Now here, David contrasts the people running right with the people running wrong, particularly people who are running after the wrong things. David says, I'm not going to run with them. Run is a verb of passion, mahar in Hebrew. It means to be swept away. It means to be impetuous, rash. Now, we don't want to get bogged down in the ancient language of worship, but think about it like this. Just apply the words of David's context to our own. We may not worship gods the way they worship gods, but oh, we worship gods. And we do so with the same passion as David. They're just different gods. We worship the God of success. We put our trust in a God of acceptance. We put our trust in a God of romance. Different gods. We put our hope in them just the same. Verse 5. David says, Lord, you alone are my portion and my cup. You make my lot secure. Lot, in its most basic sense, is the plot of land that you were allotted. So think of in the early days of the people of God settling into Canaan land, and Joshua, under God's direction, they divide up the land, clan by clan, family by family, and you get this plot of land, and you get this plot of land, and your land's a big deal to you, okay? And eventually, this whole idea of your lot in life became known as all that God gave you, right? Well, here's what David says. David makes this claim. Actually, God, you are my lot. You are my portion. You are my cup. Now, that's interesting, because originally only the Levites could make that claim. So the Levites were one of the 12 tribes of Israel. And when the people settled the land, the Levites, out of the 12, were the only tribe that didn't get any land. It's because they were appointed to be priests of God, working for God. And what God promised them was this. Instead of land, he says, you get me. And thereby God promised to take care of those families for generations, even without land to tend and till. Now, eventually, other tribes of Israel started to make that claim for themselves. Why? Probably because they knew the Levites got the better deal. No, actually, God, you are my portion. You are my cup. You are my provision. David says, you make my lot secure. You will give me everything I need to do, everything you want me to do. Look at verse 6. The boundary lines, David says, have fallen for me in pleasant places. Surely I have a delightful inheritance. David looks at all that he has and he sees it as a gift from God. And he sees it with gratitude. Thank you, God, for all that you've given me. See, friends, that's what runners who are running their race sound like. They're grateful. Hebrews 12, verse 1. Look at the last part of this verse. Let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us. Here's the problem. A lot of us don't like the race that was marked out for us. In fact, I'd rather have his race. I'd rather be running her race. And I'm looking at her race as I run into a taco stand. Now, runners who run right celebrate what God has given them with gratitude. They trust him. They trust him. Look at verse 7. I will praise the Lord who counsels me. Even at night, my heart instructs me. This is David recognizing that God is a God who gives wisdom. You don't know which way to go left. You don't know which way to go right. God is a God who guides us all along the way. He knows he can depend upon God to guide him, even in the dark, even in the dark of night. Friends, this verse answers the prayer I pray most often for wisdom. The way I'm wired, for whatever reason, I don't have a lot of fear of the big things, like the big calamitous things. They're so out of my hands, it's just so easy for me to trust God with those things. You know what my problem is? My lack of faith centers on the little things, especially the things that I have control over. I'm scared I'm going to screw it up. Oh God, oh God, oh God, oh God, oh God. David says, I will praise you, God, because you counsel me. Runners who run right know that's true and run like it's true. Then, verse 8. I keep my eyes always on the Lord. With him at my right hand, I will not be shaken. This is the key verse of the psalm. It's the secret to running right. Here it is in the English Standard Version, verse 8. I have set the Lord always before me. Because he is at my right hand, I will not be shaken. The psalm instructs me to intentionally focus my mind on God. That word set, it translates a Hebrew word shavah. It shows up seven times in the Hebrew scriptures, and all seven passages describe a deliberate action of placing or positioning something somewhere intentionally. The psalm instructs me to intentionally focus my mind on God, to set my sights on him. When I do that, I remember the Almighty, all-loving God is at my right hand. Now, of course, I know he's there. He's always there. I just don't always feel like he's there. I don't sense him there. But when I focus my mind on a verse like this, it is reminding me, no, he's here, even if I don't feel like he's here. That's fixing my mind on him. That's considering him as I run my race. And hear this, to paraphrase Dallas Willard, a mature disciple of Jesus must be very intentional what she allows herself to think, what she allows herself to feel. His point is, we are in control of what we think and feel, even if we don't feel like we are. But when I walk through a difficult day actively remembering that God is at my side, he keeps me from being shaken. That's the point of the verse. When I intentionally set my sights on him, he keeps me from being shaken. I don't know about you, but I'm sick of being shaken. I don't want to be shaken by anxiety or stress. I don't want to be shaken by bills or broken relationships. When I set the Lord before me, I internalize the belief that God is with me. And if God is with me, I don't have to be afraid. I don't have to worry about not being talented enough, not having enough time, not having enough money. When I set the Lord before me, nothing's going to shake me. What's shaking you? What's shaking you these days? Maybe you're in a season of suffering that's shaking you. And seasons of suffering when things aren't going our way. Have you noticed your fuse is shorter? Have you noticed you're more easily frustrated? Have you found yourself blaming others and grumbling about all the incompetent idiots around you? If so, grace to you, but I don't think you're running right. Here's an observation of my soul. If I'm grumbling, I'm not running right. If I'm fearful or frustrated, I'm not running right. I told you at the end of last year, I knew I wasn't running right. And one of the ways I can tell, because I'm not as fun to be around. See, people who get running right are a joy. Even when they're racing uphill in a torrential downpour. But when you're running wrong, you take it out on the people around you. When you're running wrong, your fear and frustration magnifies the flaws and foibles of others. When you're running wrong and people disappoint you, you respond with a graceless impatience that makes others fearful and frustrated and perpetuates problems and pain. Jesus says you don't have to run wrong anymore. He wants to help. He wants to run with you. And when Jesus is running with you, he is constantly encouraging you. And when Jesus is running with you, who are we kidding? Half the time, he's carrying you. Here's the confession of a runner who's running right. Verse 9, therefore my heart is glad and my tongue rejoices. My body also will rest secure. Because you will not abandon me to the realm of the dead, nor will you let your faithful one see decay. There's this promise we find woven throughout the Bible. Never will I leave you. Never will I forsake you. That promise actually shows up in the next chapter of Hebrews, Hebrews 13. Finally, verse 11, David writes, you make known to me the path of life. You will fill me with joy in your presence and eternal pleasures at your right hand. My friends, I'm going to challenge you to run to Jesus, like Jesus, with Jesus. That's my prayer for you. That's my prayer for me. I'd like to pray it now. Lord, I pray you give us the faith to run our race right. Give us the faith to fix our eyes on you in very practical ways throughout a day. Help us to realize this is not something we do generally. This is something we do specifically. And we find intentional, creative ways of fixing our hearts and our minds on you throughout a day so we can run our race right. Help us to find those ways of doing that. A lot of people in this room were like me. Didn't like the race we were running. At least the way we were running it. But God, I pray you show your grace. A grace that forgives. And a grace that helps. A grace that helps us do what we can't do on our own. Teach us how to run our race right. Free of fear, free of sin, full of love and forgiveness and grace. Some people listening to this message right now have had a really stagnant race. In fact, some of us have been detoured. Lord, let us see this message as a sign. Get back on track. Calling us to get back on track. Some of us have become so weary, we've lost strength and we've stopped running. Lord, I pray this message is a reminder, though we're exhausted, though our souls are weary, there are things we can do to focus our mind and our hearts on you. Today and tomorrow and the next. I pray you give my friends the faith to do that, and when they do, I pray you lift them up. I pray you dust them off so they can get back into the race. Lord, I pray they sense your gentle encouragement. And for those who need it, may they hear the very direct words of you as coach saying, come on, let's do this. Lord, I pray you make this true today in the lives of the people listening. And I pray also for my friends who don't know you yet. Lord, I pray that their hearts would be open. Their eyes would be open to see who you really are. All your love, forgiveness, your grace, your truth. And I pray they'd find the faith to trust you, to entrust their entire lives to you. I pray this in the name of King Jesus. Amen. Okay, can we talk homework? I got two assignments for you this week. Here's the first one. As a way to run your race to Jesus, like Jesus, with Jesus, I'm going to invite you to immerse yourself in Psalm 16. Immerse yourself in it. I mean, step into it and walk around in it. There are passages in the psalm that are a little tricky. You'll be all right. You'll figure it out. Really. Dive into this psalm and see what God says to you. Now, there are a number of ways you can do this. You can do it all in one sitting. Maybe you take just a verse a day and ponder that verse and what that means. Now, here's the deal. You got to ponder it with Jesus. Just on your own, not in your own way, in your own intellect. Well, it certainly will involve intellect, but do it in partnership, prayerful partnership with Jesus. And look to him and say, Lord, what do you want me to learn? What do I need to know when I look at verse 1? What do I need to pray when I look at verse 2, immerse yourself in Psalm 16 and see what happens. That's what happened to me yesterday. That's why you got the sermon you got today. Most of you know I have this discipline that usually once a week on my writing days when I'm writing these messages, I have this discipline where I set my phone to buzz every hour. And whatever I'm doing, usually when I'm writing, I will stop what I'm doing and I'll return to my prayer journal. I have this prayer journal I just keep on my computer. It's just a Microsoft Word document. It's nothing fancy. And every hour I just keep a log and I return to a passage of scripture at that hour. So yesterday I was working through Psalm 16 all day. So I started with verse 1. Read it. I said, Lord, what do you want me to learn here? And I just start typing my prayers to God. See, it's a prayer journal. It's not Dear Diary. It's a prayer journal. And I'm saying, Lord, what about this? Tell me about that. What would you like for me to see there? And I find the actual act of doing that, of typing it, focuses my thoughts. Heck, you might find it helpful for you. Put it into practice. See what happens. Okay? That's your first assignment. Here's your second one. Ready? Be baptized. Be baptized. Baptism is the New Testament biblically prescribed way of saying to God and to the world, I'm in. I have put my trust in Jesus. That's the biblically prescribed way of doing so. And if you haven't been baptized and you're at that point where you put your trust in him, I want to encourage you to do so. First, I want to talk to those of you who are new to faith. Maybe you've been on this journey with us in our church community for a while, and you realize, my word, I'm ready. I'm ready to turn from a life of trusting myself or trusting this or trusting that, and I want to put all my eggs in God's basket instead. That's an old Southern expression. Half of you have no idea what I just said. It was not a reference to snooze. No, you want to say, God, I want to put my hope in you. Teens, students, you're sitting right in front of me, some of you. I want to encourage you. If you're at a place where you've made a decision of faith to trust Jesus, I want to encourage you to get baptized. I know my pal Dustin would love to baptize you in the coming days. Think about it. Think about it. Put deliberate thought into this. And here's the deal. Some of you have already been thinking about it. Maybe this is God's sign to you. Sco. Let's do this, okay? Secondly, I want to talk to somebody else. I want to talk to those of you who have been journeying with Jesus for 10, 20, 30, 40 years. And you've never been baptized. And look, I know how these things happen, okay? Depending on your church tradition, oh, you know, you came to faith and it's like, well, yeah, you should have been baptized, but then the pastor got sick and then you were out of town and then this happened and that's happened and, well, that didn't really work out. And before long, a couple years go by and then a couple decades go by and here you are. You're like leading a Bible study for Pete's sake and you haven't been baptized. And to be honest, you just feel weird. It's embarrassing. And you know what's going to happen. Troy's going to want to film a video of you telling your story. And you don't have a story. You don't have a story. I mean, like, there's part of you that's like, you kind of want to go to Vegas for a weekend and throw your life away so you can come back with a story. Hey, don't do that. Please don't do that. Here's what I'm going to ask you to do. I'm going to ask you to tell your story because we need that story. We need your story. We need stories of people who are saying, I am getting baptized today because God has proven his faithfulness to me over the last 10 years or 20 years or 30 years. He's proven himself faithful to me even when I haven't been faithful to him. And today I'm just responding to Jesus' call to obedience by being baptized. I take my faith seriously. Now see, that's the kind of video we need as well. You hear me? So if you haven't been baptized yet and you're a follower of Jesus, I want you to consider doing this right now, this season. Sco. Here's what you can do. We have connection cards in the seat backs in front of you. You could fill out that, give us your information. You flip it over. There's a box on the back. Right at the top, it says baptism. Check. You could check that. If you don't have a seat back in front of you, like those of you who are in the overflow, wow, thanks for being there way in the back. You're way in the back. Hi. And it's so, I know, we should have had five services, and we didn't do it, and we should have. So thanks for being back there. You don't have any connection cards, so here's what I want you to do. Send us an email, info@capitalchurch.com. Tell us you'd like more information about getting baptized. We'll contact you this week. You hear me? And don't wait. I mean, if you've made the decision of faith, oh, good night. Let's go. We have a baptism class coming up on February 16th. That's the one that's on Sunday. If you'd like to attend the one that's on Saturday, it will be in our Park City location at 4 p.m. on the 15th. We'd love to tell you more about baptism, what it is, why we do it, how we'll do it, and get you some of that information. So sign up now. Please stand. Here's a verse for the week, Psalm 16, verse 8. I read it to you earlier, so I won't read it again. But friends, I think this is one you'll want to commit to memory. I'll tell you, doing so, that is actually my favorite way to fix my eyes on Jesus, to consider him, to set him before me. What I do is I take a passage like this, and this particular passage I have returned to thousands of times over the years. So here's what I'll do. If I'm in a moment of panic, if I'm in a moment of dread, if I'm in a moment where I'm shaken by the circumstances of life, in that moment when I'm rattled, in my heart, I say to myself and I say to my Lord, Lord, I keep my eyes on you. I set you before me. Because with you at my right hand, I won't be shaken. And what he does is he props me back up as I do that, as I make a habit of doing that. Put it to practice, see what happens. You can download this image from our website, be watching for it tomorrow, as well as this graphic. Run to Jesus, like Jesus, with Jesus. Friends, if you'd like to receive prayer, before you go, there will be some people standing here at the front to pray for you, so make your way up and invite them to do so. This is what I'm going to pray for all of you. May you run to Jesus and like Jesus and with Jesus so you will not be shaken. Thanks for coming today. Grace and peace.